Lecture 11, Beliefs About Yourself.
Human beings are unique among all animals in our ability to think consciously about ourselves. Although certain other species show some basic ability to self-reflect, no other animal can think about itself in the complex and abstract ways that we can. You spend a lot of time thinking about yourself each day, and those thoughts have an ongoing effect on your emotions, your behavior, and the quality of your life. And underlying all of those individual thoughts that you have about yourself are a large number of basic beliefs about who you are, what you're like, what you ought to be like, what you used to be like in the past, and what you might be like in the future. Many differences among people come down to differences in the beliefs they have about themselves and how they evaluate themselves on various dimensions. Even when your beliefs about yourself are not accurate, they contribute to your individuality. Or to look at it differently, imagine two identical clones, two people who were genuinely identical in every way. If we changed nothing other than a few beliefs they have about themselves, maybe we made one person believe that he was less socially skilled, or made the other one think he was more physically attractive. Even if they were exactly the same, tweaking just a few of their beliefs about themselves would change the way they thought, felt, and behaved in a major way. So understanding people requires that we give some attention to their beliefs about who they are and what they're like. In this lecture, we're going to take a look at four types of self-related beliefs. Identity, who people think they are and what they think they're like. Self-efficacy, people's beliefs about what they think they're capable of doing. Self-esteem, people's evaluations of themselves. And self-compassion, how people think about themselves when bad things happen. If you and I met, and I said, "Tell me about yourself," what would you tell me? Setting aside your concerns with what kind of an impression you might make, if you wanted to really help me understand who you are and what you're like, what would you tell me about yourself? If I said, "Tell me 30 things about who you are," what 30 characteristics would you parade out? I wish we had time for you to actually make a list right now. It's a very informative exercise. When researchers have people do this sort of thing, have them list things that help to identify them as a unique human being, they obviously list a very big variety of specific things about themselves. But interestingly, virtually everything that people report generally falls into only four, sometimes five, basic categories. First, if I asked you about yourself, you might mention physical or biological characteristics. You might mention that you're a man or a woman, or tell me your race or your age. You might mention your height, particularly if you're unusually short or tall. Or tell me that you're diabetic or hard of hearing or particularly energetic. Second, some of the characteristics that you'd mention would involve personal attributes that you possess. Some psychologists call these things your self-concept, but I prefer to call them personal identity characteristics. They're things that describe you that don't involve your relationships with other people. So if you tell me that you are religious, or you play the piano, or you're afraid of spiders, or you like Stephen King novels, those are personal aspects of your identity. But other aspects of your identity involve your social relationships with particular other people. These aren't personal identity characteristics like being religious or afraid of spiders, but rather they're parts of your identity that reside in your relationships. So if you tell me that you're someone's husband or wife, or mother or father, or somebody's friend, or that you're a coach for your kid's soccer team, those are social identity characteristics that involve your connections with other people. A fourth aspect of your identity involves your membership in whatever groups and collectives you belong to. You might mention that you're a member of a certain club, or a citizen of a particular country, or that you go to a particular church, or were in the marching band, or played on a particular team. These parts of your identity involve membership and social connections, not with individual people, but with a group of some kind. We call these aspects of your identity collective identity characteristics. Now, most of the things that make up people's identities fall in these four categories: physical, personal, social, and collective identity characteristics. But sometimes people mention some broader or transcendental identity that doesn't fall into one of these four. For example, seeing yourself as a child of God or as part of the cosmos would be classified as one of these broader aspects of personality and identity. Although everybody's identities include physical, personal, social, and collective characteristics, people differ in the proportion of their identity that falls into each of these categories. If you and I both listed 30 things that describe us, you might have a different pattern of identity characteristics than I do. So, for example, are you mostly defined in terms of your personal identity characteristics? Your goals, motives, traits, abilities, interests, and other personal characteristics? Or in terms of your social identity characteristics, your relationships with family and friends and other people? Your identity contains both personal and social identity characteristics, but which set is a bigger part of the way you see yourself? Or are they more or less balanced? The answer to this question is important because it reflects what parts of your identity are most important to you, and whatever is most important determines your primary focus and primary goals as you walk through life. Let me show you what I mean. I once did a study in which we measured people's personal and social identity orientations, the degree to which their identities were based more on personal or social characteristics. In addition to measuring their personal and social identity orientations, we asked these people to rate the importance of 20 job characteristics, the degree to which each of 20 things was important in determining the kind of job they would most like to have. The results showed that people's ratings of job characteristics were related to the degree to which their identities were dominated by personal and social identity characteristics. People whose identities were defined more strongly in terms of personal characteristics preferred jobs that fed into their personal identity. They indicated that the most important characteristics of the job that they would like to have were things such as finding self-fulfillment in the job, having a job consistent with their values, being able to use their abilities to their fullest, having a job that fostered their personal development, and being able to make a significant contribution. Now compare those job characteristics to the characteristics that were rated highest by people whose identities were strongly composed of social identity attributes. The job characteristics that people with a social identity orientation rated highest were things such as having good relationships with coworkers, getting recognition, having a job with an active social life, becoming friends with the people you work with, becoming well-known, and having a good-paying job. That's a very different set of considerations than the ones preferred by people with a high personal identity orientation. People who construed their identity in different ways preferred quite different kinds of jobs. In another study, we looked at how identity related to people's reasons for exercising. Again, we found that people with different identity orientations gave different reasons for being physically active. Having a predominantly personal identity orientation was associated with reasons such as improving one's health and physical condition, feeling better physically, and self-satisfaction, all personal reasons. But people with a predominant social identity orientation, said that they exercised in order to interact with other people and to look better, which are clearly social reasons. You know, sometimes we look at other people's choices in life, and we can't understand why in the world they make the choices they do. We just don't get it. And one reason is that they have a different dominant identity orientation than we do. Each of us prioritizes things that feed the dominant aspects of our identities. People's identities affect their behavior in their lives, but other self-related beliefs are also important. One such set of beliefs involves people's beliefs about whether they can do certain things or accomplish certain goals. In everyday language, we might call this variable self-confidence, but psychologists usually call it self-efficacy. Psychologists are interested in self-efficacy because people's beliefs about whether they can do something or not are important anytime people undertake challenging tasks at school or at work or on the athletic field or in the studio or wherever. Self-efficacy is important because it determines whether people will engage in certain behaviors or seek certain goals. There's obviously no use trying to do something if you don't think you can do it. So beliefs in one's self-efficacy are exceptionally important. Self-efficacy affects people's motivation, as well as their ability to cope with setbacks and failures and other problems. Now, of course, we each believe that we can do some things well, and we each know that other things would be impossible for us. I have reasonably high self-efficacy in my ability to, say, conduct research in psychology or play the drums. But my self-efficacy with respect to being a successful ballet dancer is pretty low. But although we each have high self-efficacy in some domains and low self-efficacy in others, people differ in how much self-efficacy they have in general. And that's where personality comes in. People who have higher overall expectations that they can do things successfully behave differently than people whose overall self-efficacy is lower. So think of how much you agree or disagree with these statements as they pertain to you. I can always manage to solve difficult problems if I try hard enough. Do you agree or disagree? Or what about the statement, when I make plans, I am certain that I can make them work? Or more broadly, do you expect that you will be able to achieve most of the goals that you set for yourself, whatever they are? Believing that you can usually solve difficult problems or that you can usually make your plans work out reflects a high level of self-efficacy. On the other hand, if you agree with the statement, if something looks too complicated, I won't even bother to try it, or agree with the statement, I give up easily, it would seem that you're lower in overall self-efficacy. Research shows that people who have higher general self-efficacy tend to be more optimistic because they're convinced that they'll usually be able to make things work. And as a result, people higher in general self-efficacy are less anxious and less depressed on average than people who are lower in self-efficacy. They also tend to be lower in fear of failure, because you don't have to worry as much about failure if you're pretty sure that you'll usually succeed. You remember the children's story about the little engine that could? The little train engine who managed to pull a long train across the mountain by chanting, "I think I can, I think I can." Well, the little engine would have scored high in self-efficacy, and it paid off. He got the train over the mountain. Does it work that way for human beings too? Sure. Like little trains, people with higher self-efficacy tend to succeed, both because they are more motivated to attempt challenging tasks and because they persist longer on tasks when the going gets rough. Not surprisingly, self-efficacy has been widely studied in educational settings because students' self-efficacy beliefs are strongly related to academic performance in school. So far, we have been talking about people's beliefs about who they are, what they're like, and what they're capable of doing and accomplishing. But of course, people are not dispassionate about their beliefs about themselves. Our self-beliefs are not just facts or descriptions. They sometimes lead us to evaluate ourselves positively or negatively, and to feel good or bad about ourselves. To say it differently, our beliefs about our characteristics and identities and capabilities, good and bad, contribute to our self-esteem. We've already talked about whether people have a motive to maintain and enhance their self-esteem. But here I want to focus on individual differences in people's level of self-esteem, what psychologists call trait self-esteem. Although people's self-esteem fluctuates as the result of things that happen to them, you obviously feel better about yourself after you've done well at something than when you've failed or been rejected. People differ in how positively they evaluate themselves overall. Some people's typical or average level of self-esteem is higher than other people's level of self-esteem. You can probably think of people you know who have lower or higher trait self-esteem overall. I want to stress, though, that although we loosely talk about people having low self-esteem versus high self-esteem, truly low self-esteem is actually quite rare. People who score relatively low on measures of trait self-esteem don't typically view themselves negatively across the board or really dislike themselves. Rather, most of the people who fall in the lower ranges on standard measures of self-esteem have a mixed or ambivalent view of themselves, whereas people with high self-esteem generally evaluate themselves positively and feel pretty good about themselves overall. People with lower self-esteem have neutral or mixed feelings about themselves. There are things about themselves that they feel good about and things that they don't. There are some people with truly low self-esteem, people who evaluate themselves negatively across the board and who dislike or even hate themselves. But those people are rare, and they're usually quite emotionally troubled, unless they fall outside of the normal variations in personality that we're talking about here. So rather than talking about low versus high self-esteem, I'll be using the terms lower and higher to make it clear that these are relative rather than absolute terms. Keep in mind that lower self-esteem people rarely have objectively low self-esteem. They're just less positive about themselves than people with higher self-esteem are. Trait self-esteem has received so much attention in psychology because it's consistently related to almost every indicator of psychological well-being that you can imagine. People with higher trait self-esteem are happier and more satisfied with their lives, and they score lower on most negative emotions. People with higher self-esteem tend to be less anxious, less depressed, less lonely, less angry, and less ashamed than people with low self-esteem are. And not only that, but from childhood through college, kids with higher self-esteem tend to do better in school. And when they grow up, employees with higher self-esteem tend to do better at work. Having higher self-esteem is also associated with having better relationships with family members, romantic partners, and friends. And people higher in self-esteem are less likely to engage in behaviors that create problems for them and for other people, such as to abuse alcohol and drugs, to join gangs, and engage in criminal behavior. There's no question that having higher trait self-esteem is usually better than having lower self-esteem. But where does trait self-esteem come from? What causes some people to have higher self-esteem than other people do? As we discussed previously, people's self-esteem is affected by the degree to which they feel valued and accepted by other people. And so trait self-esteem reflects the degree to which people believe that they are generally a socially valuable and acceptable person. All of the things that predict high self-esteem are things that indicate that one has socially valued characteristics. So, doing well in school or being a valued employee predicts trait self-esteem. Seeing oneself as a competent or smart or athletic or attractive person also contributes to trait self-esteem because other people value those things. In the same way, having good relationships makes us feel acceptable. So, personality differences in trait self-esteem reflect differences in how acceptable people feel. It's an effect of perceiving oneself as having desirable characteristics that other people value. But, as we saw earlier, high self-esteem doesn't cause positive outcomes, such as doing well in school, having a good job, being liked, or having good relationships. High self-esteem is the effect of these things because they indicate that the person has socially desirable characteristics. And likewise, high self-esteem doesn't cause happiness or protect people from anxiety, depression, or other emotional problems. People aren't happier because their self-esteem is high or anxious and depressed because their self-esteem is low. Instead, believing that you have socially desirable characteristics that make you valued by other people causes positive emotions and reduces negative emotions. So self-esteem is an important characteristic, but not for the reasons that most people assume. The differences in people who are lower versus higher in trait self-esteem can be traced to differences in their beliefs about having socially valued characteristics that make them liked and accepted by other people. And those beliefs lead to different patterns of emotions and behavior. Although researchers have started to realize that self-esteem might not be as important as once thought, no one would doubt that certain ways of thinking about oneself are more beneficial than others. We all know people who create a great deal of unhappiness for themselves simply by how they think about themselves and their lives. In fact, many people are pretty mean to themselves inside their own heads, beating themselves up for their shortcomings and failures, agonizing over their difficulties, blowing their problems out of proportion, and talking to themselves in ways that are far meaner and more critical than they would ever talk to somebody else. Other people, though, take a kinder and gentler approach to themselves. They might not always be happy with themselves, but they accept the fact that everybody has shortcomings and problems and makes mistakes, and they don't criticize themselves unnecessarily for the normal problems of everyday life. These two reactions to one's shortcomings, failures, and problems might appear to reflect a difference in self-esteem. But the key difference involves not self-esteem, but rather self-compassion. That is, the difference lies not in how people evaluate themselves, self-esteem, but rather in how they treat themselves, self-compassion. And as it turns out, self-compassion may be more important for well-being than self-esteem is. Just as compassion involves a desire to minimize the suffering of other people, self-compassion reflects a desire to minimize our own suffering and to avoid creating unnecessary unhappiness for ourselves. Self-compassionate people treat themselves in much the same caring and kind and supportive ways that compassionate people treat their friends and family members when they are struggling. Self-compassionate people approach their problems and failures and shortcomings with warmth and concern rather than with judgment and self-criticism. And as a result, they react to life with greater equanimity, not downplaying the seriousness of their challenges, but also not being overwhelmed by negative thoughts and feelings. Research has shown that self-compassion is strongly associated with psychological well-being. Dozens of studies have assessed people's level of self-compassion along with indicators of good and bad psychological adjustment. And this research shows that people who are higher in self-compassion show greater emotional stability. They're more resilient. They're more optimistic. And they're more satisfied with their lives. They're also less likely to display signs of psychological problems, such as severe depression and chronic anxiety. People who are high in self-compassion deal more successfully with negative events, such as failures and rejections and loss, than people who are low in self-compassion. Whether the problem is a minor daily hassle, a major traumatic event, or some chronic problem, people who treat themselves with care and compassion respond more adaptively to life's challenges than people who lack self-compassion. Self-compassionate people try to be kind to themselves in the face of whatever difficulties they experience. Again, much like they would respond to a loved one who is having similar problems. To understand how self-compassion works, think about how people respond to negative events. When something bad happens, it's perfectly natural and normal to experience negative emotions, whether we're dealing with a failure, a rejection, a health problem, losing our job, a speeding ticket, or just a misplaced set of car keys. Part of our emotional distress is a reaction to the negative implications of the event itself. It's perfectly natural to be upset when bad things happen. But people often add to their distress by how they think about things. For example, if you go beyond thinking about the original negative event and start thinking about your own incompetence, stupidity, or lack of judgment, you'll pile a second layer of distress on top of the original reaction. Of course, assessing your responsibility for a problem is sometimes useful, but people often go beyond an objective assessment to blaming and criticizing and even punishing themselves. This self-inflicted cruelty increases whatever emotional distress the original problem is already causing. People who are high in self-compassion are less inclined to inflict additional suffering on themselves through this kind of unnecessary criticism and self-blame. Again, the parallel with other-directed compassion is informative. I may not be able to make my friend who lost his job feel better, but I'll certainly not want to make him feel worse by telling him what a failure he is or how stupid he was to take that job in the first place. Yet people who are low in self-compassion often talk to themselves in precisely that way. Of course, self-compassion doesn't eliminate the original problem, so people will still be upset, anxious, sad, or whatever. Even so, people can reduce some of the initial angst by responding in a kind and gentle manner. Just as we can soothe another person's upset through concern and kindness, people high in self-compassion can soothe themselves. Let me give you one example. Getting older involves many undesired physical and mental changes for most people, such as when people can't remember things or have trouble performing everyday tasks. Even though they would treat their friends' struggles with kindness and compassion, many older people become self-critical and angry. They beat themselves up, bemoan the fact that they can't function like they used to. But research shows that older people who are higher in self-compassion cope better with the challenges of aging than those who are less self-compassionate. And as a result, they have higher well-being, fewer emotional problems, and are more satisfied with their lives. They also say that they think they're aging more successfully. I want to stress that self-compassion is not just positive thinking. In fact, self-compassion is associated with a more realistic appraisal of one's situation and one's responsibility for it. When people don't add to their distress through self-recrimination and catastrophizing, they can look life more squarely in the eye and see it for how it really is. Self-compassionate people have a more accurate and balanced and non-defensive reaction to the events they experience. And self-compassion isn't indifference to what happens or to how one behaves. And it's not an excuse to be lazy or shirk responsibility or to not care about what happens. Instead, self-compassion is based on a desire to want the best for oneself. Just as compassion for other people involves a concern for their well-being and a desire to relieve their suffering, self-compassion involves wanting the best for oneself and responding in ways that promote one's well-being. By and large, it seems to be a very useful personality characteristic to have. Self-compassion is a relatively new area of research in psychology. In fact, the construct didn't even appear in the research literature until 2003. So although there's been a good deal of research on the relationship between self-compassion and psychological well-being, we don't know much yet about why some people are more self-compassionate than other people are. That question requires longitudinal research over many years to study how parenting practices and personal experiences during childhood and adolescence contribute to a low or high degree of self-compassion. We have seen in our discussions about beliefs about oneself, beliefs about the world and other people, and traits related to thinking, that people's beliefs constitute an important part of personality. Because aspects of personality are rooted in people's habitual patterns of thoughts about other people, the world, and themselves. The most direct route to changing problematic aspects of one's personality is often through changing one's thoughts. So when you realize that some aspect of your personality is creating some problem for you, give some thought as to whether the difficulty lies in some set of beliefs or some pattern of thoughts that you have.